You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, a kids' TV show just introduced a new character with autistic traits. We'll get the details on what it means for autistic and non-autistic viewers alike.
First, there was a public hearing today on a Wisconsin bill that would close a so-called dark store loophole. The loophole allows big box stores like Walmart and Menards to successfully argue that their stores should be given the same property value as empty stores of the same size, which is why it's called the dark store loophole. The argument allows big box stores to pay much less in property taxes.
Senator Roger Roth is the sponsor of a Senate bill to close the dark store loophole, and Representative Mark Spreitzer sponsors the assembly version of the bill. Senator Roth is a Republican from Appleton. Representative Spreitzer is a Democrat from Beloit. Senator Roth, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Representative Spreitzer, thanks to you as well.
Glad to be here as well.
Well, Senator Roth, let's start with you. We briefly said what the dark store loophole is. How does this affect local governments?
Well, local governments are only, they raise their revenue from two classes of property. They go through the commercial class or the residential class. And when businesses fight their assessments and bring down the assessment value on that property, local governments have no choice but to make that up in other ways, either higher taxes for smaller businesses or through residential property. It comes from our schools. It comes from our fire departments. And that's why this is so important. I want to stress, we are not raising taxes on businesses. All we are doing with this legislation is making sure that there is equity in the assessing process so that everybody across those two classes pays a fair share of the value of those properties.
And Representative Spreitzer, is this a growing problem, companies challenging their tax assessment?
This is a growing problem, and once companies have success with it in one community, they hire lawyers and go to every community that they locate in and challenge the assessments there. And so we've seen large businesses that have the ability to do that, that are doing that in every single community that they have stores, and they bring in that track record of success and often get the community to settle and agree to a lower assessment without even going through the full process because they already think they're going to lose. And so they've been shifting more and more of the tax burden onto, as Senator Roth said, either smaller businesses that don't have those lawyers to challenge their assessments or onto residential property owners.
And I want to walk through how this works to make sure I've got this right. I own a big store. I'm probably a chain. I'm in a community. I can go to court and say, hey, when you assessed my property, you didn't take into account that old store across town that's been closed for 5 years. That represents the value of my store, so you need to bring down my assessment. That's basically what we're talking about here?
That's correct. Now, it should be noted that in the past, anyone, businesses, and even residents had the ability to challenge their assessments. They've done it in the past. They can do that now. Mm-hmm. Even under this bill, they will have that recourse in the future. It's very important. We're not taking that away from individuals. We just, again, want to bring that fairness and equity in the process. And in my area, I can tell you that, you know, it's starting right now with a trickle. That's why we're bringing forth these bills now. We want to hem the tide and make sure, you know, for the city of Appleton, this has cost them $800,000, which is a lot of money, but nowhere near what it could be if everyone took advantage of this loophole.
And this loophole, I mean, the courts have said, yeah, this is a real thing. As of right now, the courts say, yeah, if a company comes to the courts, they can use that empty building across the street as part of their challenge, right?
That's right. The good news is we can fix that by changing state law because the courts are just interpreting current state law. And if we clarify our intention that you should not use a dark store, meaning a store that is closed down and potentially abandoned, to set the value of a store that is operating for tax purposes, if we make that clear in the law, then we can override that court decision and make sure that every business is taxed fairly.
Representative Mark Spreitzer is with us from Beloit, a Democrat, and Senator Roger Roth from Appleton, a Republican, part of a bipartisan effort to close what's called the dark store loophole. So, Senator Roth, talk us through what this bill would do exactly.
Sure. Well, it's two bills, and one of them deals particularly with the dark and vacant property. The other one deals with leases and using those in determining the value of property. So on the dark store issue, we have instances happening all across the state where a business moves from one location to another. They will put a deed restriction on the old location, meaning that you can't use it for its highest and best use. Say, for instance, it was a hardware store. They put a deed restriction saying a future owner cannot use this as a hardware store. They build their new building on the other side of town, and then they challenge in court saying they should be assessed what the old vacant building is valued at. Unfortunately, because they put the deed restriction in there, that building can't be used for its highest and best use, and therefore its property level in value is far lower than the new building. The second aspect deals with leases, and there are three approaches to valuing property right now: the sales comparison approach, the cost approach, and the income approach. And when you're dealing with leases, the income approach, you absolutely have to be able to take into account the value to the property owner in leases. And right now, because of the 2008 court decision, they cannot do that. What this bill will do is overturn. We're basically telling the courts, no, we believe you got it wrong in 2008, and we absolutely want our assessors to be able to value, to take the income that businesses are paying in leases. So it's not profits that they're making in their business. No, it's the rent they're paying. You apply a market capitalization rate to it, and that's how we generally across America for the last century have valued commercial property. We want to go back to that status quo.
Representative Spreitzer, I assume that this is not a Wisconsin-only story. Have you seen how other states have dealt with this issue?
I'm not familiar with the details of how other states have dealt with this issue, but obviously it's something that many of the businesses we're talking about exist across the country, and it's something that other states are taking action to deal with, and so Wisconsin needs to do that as well. You know, given that some of these court decisions go back to 2008, you know, we've had almost a decade now of this not being addressed, and so even when I was on the city council, we were starting to see businesses challenging their assessments using these loopholes and devaluing their property for tax purposes. And so it's long past time to fix it, and I hope we do that this session.
And Senator Roth, I've seen Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, other business groups saying, well, hold on, you're creating basically a special category for us. You're singling us out as one kind of taxpayer, not applying this to homeowners, other kinds of commercial or industrial property. This is unconstitutional.
Well, I want to be pointedly clear. I am not trying, and both the authors and those who have signed on to this bill, we are not trying to invent new ways to tax businesses. Absolutely. I totally get why they challenge their assessments. I want people to pay as little taxes as they have to. But when we do have intent in how to value property, I want to make sure that's addressed fairly across the board. I will tell you that opponents of this legislation have said that states like Indiana have enacted similar legislation only to repeal it because it didn't follow the uniformity clause. I can tell you that we've drafted this, we've learned from other states' mistakes, and we've drafted this in such a way is where I'm very confident that this will stand up to our state's uniformity clause.
And Representative Spreitzer, what have you been hearing in response to this bill, just in talking to constituents, hearings, and elsewhere?
Well, many constituents aren't necessarily familiar with the issue, and they don't realize that they may, in fact, be paying higher property taxes on their homes because of these loopholes. But when people hear about it, they absolutely want it to be addressed. And I certainly hear a lot from city officials who are very familiar because they're the ones that have to pass that tax burden on to other taxpayers when businesses use these loopholes. And I wanted to echo what Senator Ross said. You know, this is not about creating a special way of taxing certain businesses. It's about closing a loophole where certain businesses have gotten very creative and found a special way to pay fewer taxes than they should if they're taxed the same way as everybody else. If you own a home, your home value is taxed based on the fair market resale value of it and not based on as if it was a vacant abandoned property that perhaps didn't have that resale.
Senator Roth, there's kind of a lot going on in the legislature right now. Are you getting much of a response from your colleagues?
We had an overwhelming response. This bill, if you look at the co-sponsorship memo, both Republicans and Democrats, about half of the legislature is signed on as a co-sponsor. We pass a lot of things in the legislature with bipartisan support. This will be, if we're able to get it on both floors and pass, this will be the most significant bipartisan bill that we get past the session, So I'm really excited. The response really has been overwhelming because people talk to their local government. They talk to folks that represent them at that level, and I can tell you they're hearing it from them, from the men and women who serve us at that level, who understand how drastically this will hurt them if we don't address it. They're hearing it from them, and they're motivated to work.
And Representative Spreitzer, a timeline.
Well, I hope that the bill can move forward this fall. It has already had a public hearing in the Assembly, and it just had a public hearing in the Senate today. So hopefully those two committees will schedule votes soon, and it can come to the floor. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to pass it this fall, given the broad support that it has.
Well, thanks so much to both of you for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was State Senator Roger Roth, a Republican from Appleton, and State Representative Mark Spreitzer, a Democrat from Beloit. They're both sponsors of a bill that would close a so-called dark store loophole, which allows big box stores to argue for lower property values and to pay less in property taxes. That bill had a public hearing today.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Before Martha Stewart and Julia Child, there was Lizzie Kander. Ellie Gettinger from the Milwaukee Jewish Museum tells us about the Settlement Cookbook and the remarkable woman behind its creation.
The Settlement Cookbook was something that I'd heard of. I grew up in Tennessee. We had one in my house, but I had no idea the history. It just was a cookbook. And I think, like many people in the United States, my assumption was that the Settlement House, if it was a place, was in New York. The Settlement House movement in Milwaukee was founded by these German Jewish immigrants who were looking at these new poor Russian and Eastern European immigrants and thinking, we've worked really hard to be, you know, to fit in Milwaukee. And there was this real fear that these new poor immigrants would reflect badly on the existing Jewish population that was primarily German speaking. So in the 1890s, they start this as a way of developing programs. And Lizzie is a really interesting woman. She was born in the United States. Her parents were German immigrants, and Lizzie actually went to high school in the 1870s in Milwaukee, which is not, most girls aren't getting that kind of advanced education. And so when she graduates high school, she actually is elected valedictorian in 1878. And the title of her valedictory address is, "When I Become President." And so after she graduates, though, that's it. You know, she's not going to college. And the role of a woman at that point, an upper-class woman, is that you get involved in good works. And she got married. She never had children. And so she then had all of this time to think about what she should be doing in her city. So she starts the organization. She recruits the people. She hires the staff. In like 1898, one of the things she initiates is a cooking class. And she has this sense that she's going to teach them how to be economical American housewives. It's not necessarily Americanizing them in the way that you think, like apple pie. You will find recipes for lots of German dishes because she is teaching them how to cook like her, an upper-class German Jewish lady. The first cookbook is published in 1901, and the impetus at first is her students are copying down recipes by hand, and it's taking a long time, and it's not efficient. And the other thing is that if you have something that's published, it has more authority than something that is handwritten. And she goes to her board of directors, all men that she's recruited, and says, "I'd like to publish this cookbook. I need $18. And they immediately say, "No, we don't think we can spare that expense. But if you find somebody to fund it, we'd be happy to share in your proceeds." Very generous of them. So she goes to the publisher, and they develop a system where they go to most of the German Jewish business people in the city, and they sell advertising for the cookbook. And that's how they get their initial investment of $18. And they do a run of 1,000. They sell it for 50 cents a piece at the Boston store. So they sell out. But it was never the sense of this was a one-time thing. She saw how successful this was and immediately starts editing it. By 1907, they do their third edition. And this is really the point when it goes from being a Milwaukee regional cookbook to a national entity. You know, there are very few books that were written in Wisconsin that have the national reach that this one does. Like, this is something that could have been so local, and that these women had this vision of, you know, we can take this and make this a national product.
This story was produced in partnership with Wisconsin 101, a statewide collaborative project to share Wisconsin's story and objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, one of the most popular kids' TV and film franchises of all times has introduced a new batch of characters, and one in particular is catching some attention. The recently released movie Thomas and Friends: Journey Beyond Soder introduces Thomas the Tank Engine to a handful of new friends who are all different from him.
My name is Thomas. I'm a tank engine. What kind of engine are you?
We are experimental engines, Thomas.
Experimental engines? Wow! What does that mean?
It means we're different. Test models. Trial and error. I'm Cap Forward, and Theo's something experimental, too.
Theo, who you briefly heard there in the clip, has been described by his creators as someone who likes understanding the world around him, but sometimes has difficulty communicating with others or being understood. Along with his other behaviors, some note that each characteristic Theo displays is a subtle reference to traits on the autism spectrum. So what does it mean for kids to see characters with autism on their favorite shows?
Wesley Dotson joins us now. Wesley's an associate professor of educational psychology and director of the Burkhardt Center for Autism Education and Research at Texas Tech University. Wesley, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first off, what is your reaction to the introduction of Theo to the Thomas and Friends TV franchise?
I think it's a wonderful step. Thomas the Train Engine is an amazingly popular character in the autism community already and has been for many, many years. And so for the creators of the show to acknowledge that relationship with a community that cares about them in a way that offers children on the spectrum a character that they can relate to and see some of themselves in, it's really encouraging, and I enjoy seeing it.
And the creators of the show, they haven't outright called Theo, said he's autistic, but Ian McHugh, senior producer of Thomas and Friends, said with the characteristics of Theo, there is an intentional nod, he says, to autism, albeit a subtle one for our autistic fan base. And so it's a subtle nod. It's not a big declaration. What do you think about making that subtlety the point?
I can't say that I prefer it, but I don't disagree with it. I think that as our understanding of the autism spectrum has matured over the years, we've realized that many people on the spectrum are not so overtly and jarringly different from everyone else that we need to make an issue of it. Many of our higher functioning individuals with autism or our students attending the schools aren't always behaving in a way that makes them look different. They may just tend to do things a little different or respond a little bit off of what a typical peer would do. So I think having a model that does not put a big flashing arrow over the top of the character and say, look at me, this is autism, can actually be a good thing. That it doesn't always have to be about having autism. It can just be about being a little different, having some different challenges from other people.
And who do you think it is that benefits the most from characters like Theo? Is it kids with autism who get to see someone like themselves on TV? Or is it maybe kids who don't have autism who can learn tolerance and learn to see an example of someone with a trait like that and have it be just another character on a TV show they love?
That's a great question. I want to believe the answer is both, that I don't have to choose between the two. I think there's great value in a child with autism being able to relate to a character. I've said in other settings that there's great power in being able to say, look at him. He's like you, and if he can do it, you can try too. And to see someone who presents with some of the same struggles and overcomes them, is accepted, that's a really powerful message. Everybody wants to feel familiar with or like other people. For the typically developing peers, I think it is important to see a model of tolerance and inclusion, although in my career, it's the kids and the peers who are often the most accepting. It's us adults who tend to put stigma on things more than kids do.
Why do you think it's taken so long? Here we are, it's 2017, and we're starting to see Julia, a Muppet with autism, and now Theo on Thomas and Friends. It seems like it's taken us a while to get here.
It has, and I think that that's a sign of the increasing awareness of autism, the increasing acceptance that being on the autism spectrum is not an automatic exclusion from being a member of the community and a productive member of society. 15, 20 years ago, getting a diagnosis of autism often meant that your entire community expected you to spend your adult life in an institution. Now we know that's different. Over half of people with autism are attempting college now, out of high school, and many more than that will attempt some kind of post-secondary education, will have a job, will attempt to be employed. They're getting married. They're living lives. As we learn more about how to support them, we're understanding that folks with autism are just folks who have a set of circumstances to deal with. And I think the media is catching up with it, and definitely shows like Thomas and Julia on Sesame Street are acknowledging that. And I think what's changed the most is simply seeing that as an influence on the characters. So we've had characters on TV shows and in movies that were based on people on the spectrum for many years, but it wasn't celebrated and it was rarely acknowledged. And I love that it's being acknowledged now.
And just briefly as we wrap up, is there any other hurdle for the portrayal of autism in the media that you'd like to see, maybe beyond kids programming?
I think that the most important message that we can send about any character in media, not just anyone with autism, but especially similarly mental illness or emotional disturbance or any of the things that are more common in the population than people realize, is to present that these are things that you will encounter, that it's guaranteed that somebody you know is on the spectrum, guaranteed that somebody you know is struggling with a mental illness, guaranteed that someone you know is struggling with emotional issues somewhere in your life, but that doesn't mean they can't have a life. And I would love to see the shows embrace the fact that they don't have to be a character defined by the condition, but are simply a character with that as something they're struggling with, but they have a life around it.
There's Wesley, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Appreciate having you.
That was Wesley Dodson, Associate Professor of Education and Director of Burkhardt Center for Autism Education at Texas Tech University.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Loneliness can be hazardous to your health. That's the conclusion of a study released this month at the annual convention of the American Psychological Association.
In a review of studies involving millions of people, the study authors found that social isolation and loneliness raise the risk of death at similar levels to the health risks of obesity, and loneliness is on the rise in the United States.
On the flip side, the authors found that higher levels of social connection were linked with a lower risk of early death.
This month's findings are part of a growing body of research suggesting that our social health has direct consequences for our physical health.
Regan Goering joins us now from our studio in Green Bay. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at UW Green Bay. Regan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You are welcome.
Well, it might not be intuitively obvious, I guess. How could loneliness affect our physical well-being?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple of different things to think about here. Firstly, you used two words, social isolation and loneliness, and I think it's important to first tease those apart. What's interesting here is social isolation is more the objective measure. So I can say, let's count up how many friends Rob has, or let's see how many times Rob emails or calls friends. That would be a measure of social isolation. Then I can ask you, Rob, do you feel alone? Are you feeling lonely? That your perception, your subjective perception, is your measure of loneliness. And I think what's interesting here is in the studies that were talked about, both social isolation and loneliness, so both the subjective measure and the subjective measure, both were related to poorer health. And to make that even more concrete, in one of the studies, and actually at that APA report, there were three different studies that were talked about, including in millions of participants. And what I think is startling is the higher social isolation led to an almost 50% higher likelihood to die early. And I think that's the startling thing, that here's something that is psychological. It's a feeling that far too often too many of us downplay that can actually have physical consequences.
What do we know about why there's that connection, why feeling lonely and why also being disconnected from people can have this very significant health outcome?
So what seems to be happening is, and I think the person who's done the most work on this is John Cacioppo down in Chicago, who has a great book on loneliness for anybody interested. It's probably one of the best compilations of the research on loneliness. And what Cacioppo and colleagues have shown is that when you get lonely, when you feel alone, it actually leads to this cascade of chemical reactions in the brain that influences your immunity, your immune system, increases your stress and the release of stress hormones, and literally causes physical changes in the body that can lead to chronic stress, something also referred to as allostatic load. So it's wear and tear on the body. And this constant wear and tear basically eats down your system and then can put you at higher risk for a whole range of negative health outcomes.
So there's the risk, and the authors attached to one of the studies they put out said, hey, we think we're getting more lonely in the United States. And there have been other pieces of research and writings. We're not joining clubs. We're more likely to live alone. We're less likely to be married. Are you worried about more social isolation and more loneliness in the United States?
Well, I think, you know, the one of the reasons that the term growing and a growing problem is attached to this is, you know, the three studies talked about at the APA meeting really spanned time from 2010 all the way to 2015. So that's a period of time, and especially in the first study. And for anybody interested, there's a wonderful study put out by the AARP that studied over 42 million Americans, and 35% of the participants in that survey rated themselves as being lonely. Now, I think when you look at trends, people have argued that perhaps we are getting more socially isolated because we may spend more time online versus seeing people face to face, you know. And I think what's really interesting there, when you try to look at trends and what's causing it, is that I don't think we can completely point the finger at the internet. There's some really interesting results relating to the internet. I dug into that AARP study a little bit more, and what they found was that amongst the people lonely and the people not lonely, internet use was approximately the same. There was no statistically significant difference in internet use between those individuals who found themselves lonely and those who did not. What's interesting is the perception. People who were lonely perceived that more internet use would make them lonely. So there's this really interesting interplay between what's actually happening and what's not. And from a trend perspective, because social media has grown so much, it's likely that people believe that the explosion of social media could be actually driving them further away. But the data doesn't exactly bear that out.
We're talking to psychology professor Regan Gurung from UW Green Bay, looking at loneliness and social isolation as health risks. Regan, a lot of this sounds like bad news, but it seems like there's also some good news here. We know this is a problem. We know more social connectedness leads to better health outcomes. So what do we start to do with this to take advantage of the good side of this story?
Well, I think the really important item here is that having social support, feeling loved, esteemed, and cared for is extremely important. And for all of us, I think cultivating our social support networks is extremely important. Making those connections, taking the time to meet with friends or keep up with your friends is really critical. And I think something that's was buried in the study that I found really fascinating is that the biggest negative impact is actually not for the very old. There's a very key age difference where the most danger of loneliness was for the age group between 45 to 49 years of age. So people 65 and above didn't seem to have as many problems with loneliness as the people who were 45 to 49. So I think when you think about what's going on there, especially if it's a family with kids, you're extremely busy, you don't have time for friends, it really does, as you said, point to, hey, people, take some time to spend time with your friends and make those connections. Also, I think it's really important for those of us who are relatively comfortable with our level of connections to look at others who may not have those connections. Be on the lookout for people who don't seem to be talking to anybody, who don't seem to have connections, because clearly their isolation can have some significant health issues.
One idea I've seen, I think, again, it was involved in these APA reports, is that maybe primary care doctors should include, you know, they ask if
Absolutely.
You smoke, they ask all kinds of questions. They should ask about your social connectedness.
Well, I think, you know, this is really matching a major trend in medicine where, you know, doctors are being urged to go beyond just the do you smoke. I mean, once upon a time, you didn't even ask about smoking, right? Now you that's one of the things that's included. Are you in pain? That's something that's relatively new. Probably next up and very important is depression. Very recently, within the last 2 years, doctors now ask, are there times in the last 2 weeks when you have felt low? That's critical. And I think in the psychological literature, depression and loneliness and anxiety are all very related. They go together. So if somebody is lonely, they are at much higher risk of being depressed. And I think adding loneliness to that mental health screening is critical because I don't think we spend enough time with mental health. You know, somebody breaks a bone, breaks a leg, we rush to their assistance. Somebody says, oh, you know what, I feel sort of low. People don't know what to say sometimes. Sometimes people avoid them. And I think we need to do a much better job of treating mental health as seriously as we treat physical health.
I wonder about that, the prescription for loneliness, though, because someone, especially if someone is depressed, say, it's easy to say, get out there, connect with people, make friends. Actually making it happen might be a tall order.
Right. And I think what complicates the issue more is the difference between actually perceived support or connections and received. So, you know, I can be sitting in my room and even though I see nobody, if I believe that I have people to see if I want to, I'll actually feel okay. You know, so it's the challenge becomes how do we actually build people's perceived sense of connection and sense of social support? How do we let people know that if they need it, we are there for them? And I think, you know, I think the onus often falls on family and friends first. But I think wherever we are, whether it's in the workplace, just being a little bit more sensitive to individuals and their states of connection, I think will go a long way. So absolutely, you're right. You can't force somebody to interact with somebody else. But I think sometimes it's just finding the right thing that will work for that individual.
Regan Goering is with us. He's a professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay. We're talking about the public health hazards of loneliness and how to turn the tide on loneliness and social isolation in the United States.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Have you had a problem with loneliness or social isolation? Have you done things to make connections and what worked for you? And if you do work in the healthcare field, do you see this as a problem? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Regan Goering is with us now. He's a psychology professor at UW-Green Bay. And we're talking about research that shows loneliness is on the rise in the United States and that it's a public health problem.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has loneliness been a problem for you at some point in your life? Have you done something to make new connections with people, maybe in a new place, maybe in a new stage of your life? If you work as a healthcare provider, do you see loneliness and isolation as a problem for your patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Mark is on the line in Delavan. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mark?
First off, the professor said about 45 to 49 really hit me because I went through a bad time there. I was not going out with friends and really upset about it. What I really wanted to do is go out and have a few drinks. Everybody's married, and I'm single. So that was hard. And then in my late 40s, early 50s, I actually lost work as a teacher and was, while I was working, looking for work, had a lot of time, and made a lot of connections on social media, on Facebook, and started to find things I wanted to do with myself. Moved from Chicago to Wisconsin, started getting involved, But even though I wasn't real involved, not a whole lot, I just felt like, you know, my perception was that I had friends largely because of Facebook.
Interesting. Mark, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And Regan, you mentioned that, you know, social media isn't the bad guy necessarily that people make it out to be, but it's a tool that we can use for good, neutral, or for bad. And it sounds like Mark found a way to use it really to help himself out.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and I think Mark also puts his finger on a couple of other things that were pretty big in those studies. Some of the key indicators or risk factors are living alone, and Mark mentioned that. Living alone, not being married, and lower income is another one. What's interesting is there aren't differences by race or education. You know, sometimes in a lot of health factors, you think that'd be educational differences in loneliness. That's not the case. And especially as far as the internet use goes, in about the 90s, there was a big scare where an article was actually published that said, will the internet make us lonely? And some years later, they actually had to recant that title because they had misinterpreted the data. And it actually showed exactly as Mark Leisney said, that internet use could actually be a great help for some people who to get their connections going.
Mark, thanks for the call, and I'm glad that moving to Wisconsin was part of the solution for you. Thanks a lot. Back to our callers now. Stacy is on the line in Grand Rapids. Stacy, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Stacy?
I'm a regional director of housing. I have housing facilities that house the elderly and the disabled. I've been doing this for 21 years. I'm really excited that this has become a conversation. You know, we put on a lot of activities. We try to encourage bonds between people where they start looking out for each other. And if they don't see you for a few days, come check your mail or whatever. They reach out and they knock and they visit. But when they don't do that, that's when they end up in the assisted living facilities. That's when they go into the nursing homes. So it does absolutely end with physical recession in their well-being as well as their health.
Stacy, thank you so much for sharing that. So building that community in this case, a new place, in this case, a senior housing home, but having that community of people who check in on each other, Regan.
Yeah, you know, and Stacy, when something that she talks about is in the social support literature, what you see is that as we grow older, our social convoys tend to get smaller and we are much more picky. So we may lose people from our convoy, but we add people very selectively. So even though the social networks of an older individual will not be as large as a younger individual, more often than not, that network is more powerful in serving a stronger purpose. So looking at people's social convoys as they age is another really big deal, is how has the number of people around a person changed as they've gotten older? And that's another big risk factor to look for if that convoy has dropped dramatically.
Stacy, thanks for that call. I want to kind of flip this around, Regan. It seems like a lot of people have issues with loneliness and losing those connections when there's a physical change in their lives. So if that softball team was their connection, that broken ankle takes away that connection. As people age, if they used to go walking with people and they have balance issues, how do we recalibrate and find new ways to connect when that old way, maybe because of a physical change, is going away?
I think the part of the answer is really being open to trying out new avenues that we haven't before. You know, right next to breaking something or having a change in your physical activity, something really big, and Mark mentioned this earlier, is moving. In a lot of the loneliness research, some of the people who are also very much at risk is within that first year of moving from one state to another. Because very often, you know, you've left all those people behind and you've got to make those new networks. I mean, reading some of that research has made me particularly sensitive to somebody moving into the neighborhood or into town or into your workplace, where you've got to realize, hey, this person has probably left their social networks behind. And whereas, you know, Facebook can help with that domain, there's nothing to beat, hey, you know, taking that person out to coffee or helping them to get to know some more people around you.
We're talking to Regan Gurung, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, looking at loneliness and the effect it can have on our health and the positive impact of social connection on our health. Tyler is on the line in Madison. Tyler, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead, Tyler.
Hi. I was just listening to the conversation and just wanted to bring up an observation I have just working as a home health physical therapist. I see all of my patients I see are homebound, and I think it's just kind of interesting to observe the contrast in the well-being in patients that are alone at home with no spouse, maybe that have passed away, or they're just alone, versus the elderly patients that I see that are in those community-based facilities, the senior apartments, where they have that social connection, and just how that directly impacts their physical health.
Tyler, thanks for that call. And we often hear about that conflict over, you know, a senior. Do they want to stay in their home? Do they want to go to a community? Where do you make that decision? Tyler, seeing positives for saying, hey, maybe being alone in my house or my apartment isn't the place for me anymore, and moving into that community.
Yeah, you know, the big thing to watch out for, though, and you mentioned, Rob, even when you mentioned breaking something or when a person's spouse dies, I think the natural tendency is for us to help that person out a lot right when that event has taken place. But that drops off, you know, and I often think about, it's great to take over food the week it's happened or the week after or the second week after it's happened. But don't forget that person still has a major life change. And I think that's where the problems come in, is the person after, let's say, the loss of a spouse gets a lot of attention in the first few weeks, but they're still feeling that pain, and we've got to try and make sure we keep that consistent.
Thanks for the call, Tyler. Kimball on Facebook got in touch and says, as someone who's an introvert who's trying to get out more, Kimball says, been the object of being ostracized in groups. I sit at a table with 5 empty chairs. Soon I'm at an empty table with no chairs. No one wants to bring the odd man in. So as we start to wrap up, Regan, this is a public health problem that anybody can make a difference on by letting the odd man in or you know, looking for that person who doesn't have that connection.
Absolutely. And I think the thing here is it's not easy for everybody to go and try and make a connection. It's not, it also takes a certain personality to walk over to a table where there's only one person sitting. But I think there are a lot of people whose personalities fit that. And I think it can be a group joint effort. But we've got to all do this together.
We'll leave it there for now. Regan, thanks a lot for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Regan Gurung. He's a professor of human development and psychology at UW Green Bay. Been talking about new research out this month on loneliness, social connection, and how it relates to our health. We're done talking about it on the air, but you can, as always, share your thoughts and your stories. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page.